Hello, and welcome to what we think is day five of the isolation pod, but at this stage it's becoming quite hard to discern one day from the next. I'm Mark Harrigan.
I'm Jana Bajcevic, and I'm still pretty sure of that fact, although I also cannot really guarantee that this is day five. But let's pretend it's day five. Welcome. One of the things that we have been discussing recently is exactly how much we have lost track of time, and how as the lockdown and the corona crisis seems to extend into infinity, both in the past and into the future, we have differing ideas of how time changes, how it flows, how it structures our everyday existence, how our everyday existence is changed by the changed experience of time, and so on and so forth. And this week, one of the things that I've been reading and thinking about is something that you sent me, actually, which is a blog post that was published on the FORES, so the Society for Social Studies of Science, blog by two Vienna-based researchers, Marsha Guganik and Nina Klimbuch-Witjes, called A Slow Conversation on COVID-19. And I found it quite interesting because they were having, well, a discussion, an online discussion, a written discussion about the relationship between academic work and the current conditions. But they expanded a bit beyond, you know, the usual approaches to either, no, don't try to be productive, or on the other hand, yes, be productive.
And I thought that was interesting, just because we so easily get locked into this dichotomy of fast and slow, acceleration and deceleration, as if we're always constantly speeding up, or we're forced to slow down as a reaction to those accelerative pressures. And they started with a really neat formulation that was similar to what we began talking about. When they write about the crisis as forcing, demanding an increase in productivity and the direction of that productivity at COVID-19 related topics. And they very astutely point to the opportunity to legitimate disciplines that on some level, even incoherently, people seem to be feeling here. That this is something, or there is some aspect of this crisis that allows sociology, anthropology, STS to say something insightful and something that demonstrates its public worth.
I mean, we've seen the same thing at the very start, perhaps unsurprisingly, with philosophers, right? I mean, both the Agamben and Žižek approaches have been very much about this, in the sense of, yes, this is exactly what we have been thinking about, writing about all along.
And I think one of the interesting ways to respond to the sense of rupture, inevitably part of crisis, is to think about the continuities that responses to the crisis have with things which came before, and a longer-term trajectory of humanities and social science disciplines, probably beyond economics, worrying about their own legitimacy is clearly something that precedes the crisis. And so if we want to understand social, scientific, and humanities responses to the crisis, we have to situate them in terms of this broader trajectory.
I think that's a very good point. And I think, to some degree, it does go back to you know, the notion of epochal theorizing that I think we have already brought up in one of these conversations. Not that I can remember what day it was. But I think it does also say something about the need to legitimize, right? To say, yes, look, we have relevance, and also what is obviously gained and lost through that sort of drive.
And one of the things that I really liked about this conversation, which, as you pointed to, is a textual conversation edited down from an email exchange, you know, which implies interesting things in its own right about the temporalities of thought and dialogue, you know, taking something that is a fast form of exchange and sedimenting it into a text as something that captures the gist of that exchange.
But on the other hand, I think it is also, and to be fair to the authors, they actually reflect on this. It is a bit paradoxical because, you know, it is taken in order to create, or it transforms into a marker of, so it transforms into an academic product. And given that they're trying to engage, I guess, critically with the concept of productivity in and of itself, then, I mean, they know that it is, in a manner of speaking, a bit of a sort of performative contradiction.
Well, I didn't mean that in a critical way at all. I mean, I think the kind of reflexivity about knowledge production that's been a theme of our discussion so far is embodied really well in that. So, you know, you think about the genre of exchange that you're engaging in. You think about the constraints and enablements of that genre, what it enables you to do and what it doesn't enable you to do. And, I mean, another aspect that really stood out in terms of what we've been trying to do with these podcast discussions is the way in which their exchange traversed the psychosocial and the institutional aspects of knowledge production. And there was a phrase that really resonated. And in my notes, I forgot to write down which of the two speakers actually said this. When one of them wrote, "The rush to the keyboards." And I thought this captured something really interesting about the kinds of action that a sense of external urgency creates, compels in social thinkers.
I think I was reminded of, well, two things, both of which are, not to sound self-serving, are actually major aspects of my own work. I mean, speaking of rush to the keyboards, right? One is the question of, you know, performativity or non-performativity of theorizing, and what is it that thinking about the social allows us to do? And I mean, I would agree with you that perhaps there is a sense of, first of all, there is a sense of continuity. There is a sense of self-validation when you say, oh, well, you know, this completely different, new, disruptive event, because I think it is in most people's experience, or for most people, completely new and disruptive. You know, this event gives me the opportunity to continue doing exactly what I had been doing prior to it, which is write about, you know, whatever, from the perspective of science and technology studies, from, you know, in Agamben's case, from sort of the theory of the state of exception and bare life and so on and so forth. So I think there is that element of, well, you know, theories have a form of performativity that is also effective performativity. So they allow you to manage anxiety in some ways. And I think the other element is, which I was personally less, I mean, I don't want to say I was less okay with, but it did, you know, I reacted to it, let's put it that way. It's the moral underpinning of what the rush to the keyboards means. So whether there is perhaps an implicit, I'm not saying that the authors are suggesting this, but I think in a lot of online exchanges, there has been almost an sort of implicit critique of people who have started writing more about the crisis, in the sense of, well, you know, if we are all in this together, then we should all be equally impacted. So no, you shouldn't be rushing to produce.
But at least one person has raised this objection to early episodes of our podcasts, suggesting that being unfair is probably the wrong term in terms of the point that was being made, but that, you know, we've been engaging in that implicit critique. Whereas, you know, I guess my response to that is to think in terms of what it means to be reflexive about what we're doing. And so if there is a kind of anxiety-laden dimension to our response to crisis in writing, my own take, and I'd be interested to hear what you think, is not that there's something inherently problematic about that, but we have to own it. If we are, to a certain extent, writing to make ourselves feel better, writing to pass the time, writing to gain some sense of traction on a situation that feels out of control, it seems important to me that we actually recognize and respond to that fact in our writing.
I mean, you know, one thing is, I have been claiming that is the case. I have been claiming that, for instance, a lot of the critique of neoliberalism stems exactly from the same, or I guess similar, but more temporally stretched experience, which is the experience of ambivalence or ambiguity implied in the fact that on the one hand, you are participating in something that you do not approve of, meaning neoliberalism, capitalism, you name it. On the other hand, you're writing about it. But as you are writing about it, you are still participating in it. And this type of contradiction, we talked about this before. I mean, this happens when you, you know, are aware of the relationship between carbon emissions and climate change, but are still flying, right? And so on and so forth. You know, you're aware of the fact that smoking is harmful, you're still smoking, etc., etc. So I think humans inhabit this ambiguous space all along. And I think extreme situations like this one make it more, I guess, more obvious how contradictory this space is, but also does possibly in some people spur this, you know, what they refer to as the mad rush, or well, rush to the keyboards, in order to manage the excess anxiety.
But what is that link? Because when I've read your writing about this, I've sometimes wondered if actually one could suggest that in part it's something, you know, Greek philosophers talked about as akrasia, as weakness of will, a failure to act on your convictions effectively, to simplify the concept quite terribly.
No, and I have always been very dismayed when people would interpret my writing like this. And I know that this has been a tendency, right? So whenever someone would write something about this particular element of analysis I had written, they would say something like, you know, and she's calling to action, that sort of thing. And I always made it very clear that my argument is not a political one. It's an epistemological one. It is literally a question of what is it that we do when we, this is what I've called gnosification, so when we turn something into an object of knowledge. And if anything, I think that what to me is very interesting is how this relates to, for that matter, another Greek concept, which is the concept of theorizing, or the theorein. And Hannah Arendt has written about that beautifully, in the sense in which, in order to think, in order to theorize, at least this is what the ancient Greeks thought, and I think is still very much an influential element, though perhaps a not very conscious one in the Western notion of theorizing, you need to be somehow separate from the world. So when you take that particular stance of writing about it, you're very clearly not involved in it at the same moment, right? Because you need to take a step back. You're never literally, even if you're writing something, you're very engaged, you're never literally on the barricades or in the thick of it.
I'm suddenly thinking back to something I saw 7 or 8 years ago now. And it's very mundane, but I'm curious if you would see this as an example of the tendency you're talking about, which was someone in the quiet zone of a London to Manchester train on what was then Virgin Trains. Weirdly, I feel nostalgic about being on Virgin Trains, which I never thought would happen.
Well, we're going to have to cut this out of the podcast. I'm sorry.
Well, we'll see. Let's discuss that afterwards. And the person said, oh, now you've distracted me. And he was talking loudly on the phone in the quiet zone, complaining about people being loud in the quiet zone. And it was one of those situations that left me literally speechless. I wanted to ask him, but I couldn't quite find the words. Was he aware of the contradiction inherent in what he was saying? And would you see this as a mundane example of the tendency you're talking about? Because I can't help but translate this into the kind of realist account of reflexivity.
Not really, in the sense in which I think it isn't only a question of self-exceptionalism, so the question of, you know, inability to perceive that faults you observe in others are also your own faults. I think it is something much more interesting, which is that, although, I mean, I don't know, the person in question might have been very, very dismayed by the loudness of the quiet carriage. I tend to be. Not that I ever react by phoning someone up and complaining about it, but on the other hand, I think it is often a response that relies on intellectualizing affectively loaded circumstances. And I think that has more to do with it. So it's not, it is to some degree a question of ignorance or sort of willed ignorance. This is something that Lindsay McGooey writes about and we've recently engaged with in a sort of a joint piece. But I think it is also just a question of management, right? In the sense of self-management, the technique of self-management, if you wish, to kind of borrow a bit from Foucault.
Well, that is ultimately what I mean by reflexivity, in terms of incorporating that into a particular sociological frame. But I think this is perhaps something that could lead into a much broader discussion.
Yeah.
And the other half of what we wanted to talk about today was a piece that Philip Fostel sent us, reflecting on the current crisis from the perspective of the sociology of time. And there were a couple of points just on the surface which I wanted to pull out about this. And the first was his observation about how common the assumption is that the crisis means there will be more time, there'll be a capacity to catch up on those edifying things that would be squeezed out pre-corona. And, you know, he, I think, very insightfully observes the how this obscures the variegated nature of the experience of time, and particularly the relationship between time and social structure. And this made me think back to when Philip and I first started talking and collaborating, because we had a shared interest in how one conceptualizes temporal structures, social structures, and their relationship to agency, which I'm not as engaged with this literature as I once was, but I think it's still something that's not done very easily. And I thought it could be interesting to discuss that at the level of expert categories, but also in the lay experience and lay conceptualization of this. We tend to think of time as something psychological through a kind of folk phenomenological lens. And even if we recognize class and the structuring of the distribution of resources, opportunities by class, even in everyday speech, we tend not to connect the two things in a systematic way.
I guess. I mean, although I, you know, the concept of time bind, the concept of time poverty are all concepts that have in some ways engaged with both, you know, the classed nature of temporal experience and the gendered nature of temporal experience, which I think is also a very, very important.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying this hasn't been done, but I think the fact that, as you say, they engage with the gendered nature of this experience, I think there's a tendency towards what you've described elsewhere as domaining in how we think about this, where the relationship between the two is seen as something that can help explain a particular category of phenomena. And our general theories of social structure tend, apart from specialists in the sociology of time, to not have much of a temporal aspect to them.
I think that's a very, very good point. And I'm wondering what the source of this omission or partial blindness might be. I mean, I have spent quite a lot of time, that word again, recently thinking about how what we think about the social theory, so the canon, for want of a better term, is structured by not only inclusions, but also systematic exclusions, by which I do not mean only the things that have been by now relatively extensively argued about, which is kind of the exclusion of, say, collaborators in terms of data collection, or obviously exclusions of Black minority, you know, women and differently gendered people, all of which are obviously relevant, but also how the idea of social thought systematically obscures certain elements, including, for instance, I think this is a very, very, very good example.
Well, I was thinking about this recently in terms of Bev Skeggs's early work, which I was teaching with first year students on the subject of social class, personhood, respectability. And it occurs to me that, I mean, that draws together domains which are usually kept separate in a way which I think is much more recognized within British sociology now. But at the time she was writing the early work, I mean, it was hugely groundbreaking. And it's interesting to think about how the disciplinary structure of domains then shapes how we relate or fail to relate social phenomena.
I think an interesting side note, perhaps, and I think this is also veering a bit away from what we have been discussing, but I think an interesting element of that is precisely the question of how social thought or social theory is taught. So what gets labeled as what in the teaching of social theory and the history of social thought, and basically what gets labeled as a very, very specific subset of that thought.
And I thought it was really helpful in the way in which Philip foregrounds an aspect of this, which I feel people are beginning to point to, but actually we really need to begin to understand, which, you know, in the terms from Bev Skeggs's work, you could see as a generalization of a classed experience of COVID and an enormous amount of symbolic violence inherent in that generalization. The kind of thing you see in kind of weekend think pieces in broadsheets. The Financial Times had an excellent example of this recently about the kind of normative pressure the author was feeling about not being sufficiently energetic in the edifying activities they were undertaking with their children during lockdown. And the fact something like that can be written, you know, it speaks of the particular forum in which it's being published, but the kind of contours of that generalization of classed experience, and to think at an ontological level about how we can begin to analyze the different elements in play to enable this experience to be treated hegemonically within the media.
I agree. I did, for purposes of research, I hasten to add,
of course,
scroll through headlines in the online edition of the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago. And I had exactly that moment of, you know, realization that, well, of course, I knew that this is what I presume the average or intended or surveyed readership of the Sunday Times does on weekends or occupies themselves with on weekends. But then again, I was also completely shocked because the absence of awareness that there is any sort of life that doesn't involve having sort of a mansion of the size and, I guess, infrastructure of, you know, own golf course, swimming pool, and sort of attending, serving staff. It was just, you know, it was amazing to me in the sense of, okay, well, yes, you had to, or, you know, what do you do if your nanny is self-isolating? Which is one of the questions that are, to me, obviously subsidiary to what do you do if you do not have a nanny? Or what do you do if you are a nanny, right?
Well, that's why it feels to me that research, obviously research done remotely because of the methodological challenge of doing research in a pandemic, is so important now, because Philip foregrounded the incredible variation in time awareness and time orientation at work within COVID. And it seems important to me both that we register that empirically, but that we also don't just keep it as empirical diversity in relation to some underlying assumed unity, but we can begin to unpick the social structuring of experiences of time with COVID.
But I do think that there is another interesting methodological element that Philip also points to, especially when he talks about how everyone is now not only locked down in their, or almost everyone, people who are visible and whose perspectives are visible are locked down in their homes, but also in their nation states. And, you know, as someone who has always been interested in theories of nationalism and state building, I have been reflecting on this a lot. I think this is one of the elements that make it so obvious that perhaps experiences are more stratified or more shared among sort of class and other types of strata than uniquely separated between nation states, in the sense in which we obviously think about this exclusion of perspectives from the standpoint of Britain, right? So this is where we're saying, oh, well, you know, there are some people who experience this in one way and there are some people who experience it in another way. But I think what for me would be a more useful angle and perhaps a way to bring back the comparative spirit of sociology, which it had, including in the UK, and I think lost to its great detriment, is to say, well, okay, you know, how do experiences of doctors compare in the UK and in France? I mean, even not to do anything more wildly comparative, right, in that sense.
Well, I had an opposite reaction, I guess, reflecting our respective interests. And the other large thrust that I took from what Philip was talking about was the role of digitalization in this. And that made me think about an argument I've been developing on and off for a while now about the kind of following the platform, not because the platform is the kind of dominating structure but just because it's an interesting analytic device to look at platforms, look at how they're embedded, look at how people relate to them, look at their effects, for tracing out these sorts of connections. And, you know, this could open up variegation in another way. So, for instance, the limited but nonetheless significant journalism that's starting to come out about the digital divide in the UK, about people who are relying, and a substantial number of people in the UK, for example, just to cite one case, who are struggling to afford additional data for their pay-as-you-go mobile phones, which are their only mode of accessing internet services and are often being distributed amongst families. And when people are already on straitened budgets, that additional demand is something really significant.
Yeah, I have been thinking about a similar thing recently, in part because I have very limited mobile data budget, in part because I have always been very strict about sort of policing my own data use. But I do also have broadband, not to mention that before lockdown, I also had access to university and other professional Wi-Fi networks. So I think that's looking at sort of platform distribution and platform participation is really one very good way of engaging with questions of scale. And I think geographers are probably going to have a really, really good time of thinking about these things in the future.
But it can also be it can also encompass the everyday life of our relationship to technology, which you know, Philip was pointing to. In terms of the professional and academic experience of this, for example, in relation to something like Zoom fatigue. And I think you used the phrase perils and pitfalls, which I think is a nice formulation of just capturing the different valences which this sudden reliance can have upon us, and particularly how they complicate the dominant narratives about technology, which have tended to oscillate between the positive and the negative, the utopian and the dystopian. I mean, he says at one point that this is not what the advocates of digitalization wanted, and that's where I would disagree very slightly, because it depends who those advocates are. And I've been thinking about this a lot in the last week when listening to webinars of edtech startups and founders and entrepreneurs, and the way in which they talk about the disruption of technology on teaching. And it's taken as a given that teachers will adapt. It's taken as a given that the standards of what is good or bad teaching should adapt to the platform. And while in that sense, I mean, my point in relation to Philip, I guess, is about taking that further step and recognizing the power relation involved in the expectation of how we will relate to these technologies.
I think that's a great point. And I think we are almost running out of time. Oh, it's okay, we have a bit more. I mean, I would say that's something that definitely plays into different experiences of time. And I have also, both in my daily experience, I guess, of lockdown and in conversations with other people, heard different perspectives on it. But I do think that Zoom fatigue is something that is beginning to become more of a sort of transversal and cross-sectoral issue. And I think it has also perhaps drawn attention to something I think doesn't get discussed nearly often enough, which is the structure of attention, right? So what does it mean to be fully present and fully engaged in an exchange, which is in this case an online exchange? And what does it do in terms of how people experience workloads? Because one of the things that I have been, I guess, aware of from the very beginning is that there is definitely a difference between attending a meeting with 10 people in person and a one-on-one meeting online.
And in my more paranoid moments, I wonder how many academics realize that Zoom administrators are able to gain access to how much of the meeting you spent looking at the window as your main point of attention, because it's very easy to see how 2 or 3 years from now that might be used as a formal metric within the university. And I find that very worrying.
Just position the computer somewhere where it's right below or right above, right next to the window. They won't be able to tell.
Well, if they hear this, then now they'll know that we can get around it. Thank you very much. And we'll do another episode soon.
Until next time.